When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The samurai, they valued honor very much. So when they were defeated on the battlefield, if they were catched and executed, that would be a shame. So they chose to cut their belly, which was a very painful thing to do. And if you cut your belly, you won't die immediately. So you will be in much pain. So that's why they have the kaishakunin, a person who helped them. And after they cut their belly, this person will cut their neck so that they will immediately die.
Hello and welcome to the pod. Today's episode sees Frederick Crins join to talk 17th century Japan, 1600 to be exact, as we see the arrival of the first Brit, a Protestant, William Adams. This conversation is as a result of my having watched the first episode of Shogun, which is a new TV show adaptation of James Clavell's novel of the same name. It stars Cosmo Jarvis, Anna Sawai, and Hiroyuki Sanada. Frederick is the historical consultant and a professor of Japanese history, and so we discuss the history of the period and not the plot. And as you heard at the top there, ritual suicide features, seppuku. Links are in the show notes, and you can give me a 5-star rating, that would be fine and dandy. Coming up on Thursday, I'm talking the attack on Pearl Harbor, the shocking event that brought the US into World War II, and Saturday's episode sees Gordon return for our Great British Commanders series with World War I also rans. Plenty more great history to come, but in the meantime, it's 17th century Japan with Frederick Crins. Frederick, very nice to meet you.
Yes, it's a pleasure to meet you. Thank you.
I should have said konnichiwa.
Yes, indeed. That's Japanese for hello.
Indeed. So I know we don't have a huge amount of time. So if you don't mind, I just thought I'd get cracking, really, because okay. I've just watched the first episode and I had a few burning questions, really, for you, because I know you're a historian of this period. And we're talking sort of 1600 Japan. Yeah. And we see an English navigator arrive in Japan. And so I guess my first question for you was, what was Japan like? There's a presence of Portuguese. There are some Christians, which surprised me, Christian converts in the Japanese population already. And I am an idiot when it comes to this period of history, so forgive my questions. But because on the one hand, it seems very hostile to this English arrival, William Adams. But on the other hand, there are Christian converts and Portuguese who seem to be thriving in their relationship with the Japanese.
Yes. So Japan in 1600 was a country ruled by warlords. So it was, you call it the samurai culture. So a caste of warriors who ruled the country. And well, they were fighting with each other incessantly. At the time, just before 1600, there was a period of calm because the Taiko, as he was called, had unified the country, but he died in 1598. And he left a council of regents to look after his infant son. And those regents were all mighty warlords who were in crosshairs with each other, of course, and who tried to get the power for themselves. And half a century before that, the first Jesuits arrived in Japan because Japan was trading with the Portuguese. The Portuguese sent every year ships to Japan with goods mainly from China, because the Chinese didn't sail at the time to Japan, and the Japanese were forbidden to go to China because they were seen as pirates at the time. So the Portuguese were like intermediates. They imported a lot of silk to Japan, which were used to make the gorgeous costumes, which you will have seen. So they needed that for the clothing industry. And with the Portuguese came the Jesuits. And they had quite a success in their work. They had a lot of Japanese who became Christians at the time, especially in Kyushu. And the Taiko, he was worried about their influence. So he banned the priests from Japan, but it was never really enforced because they needed the Portuguese for trade. So at the time, 1600, the Christians were officially banned, but still they could do their job and preach in certain places. So they didn't have that much power, but still they had enough power to, for example, negotiate between the Portuguese and the Japanese.
I see.
That was the situation of Japan in 1600. And so when William Adams landed in Japan on a Dutch ship, the Portuguese, they were at war with the Dutch and also with the English at the time. So they immediately informed the authorities, Japanese authorities, that these were pirates and that they had to be executed. So that's a little bit of historical background of the period.
Yeah, it's really well done, actually, in the show. The Japanese, what was their approach to foreigners generally? Because presumably everyone, I think many people will be aware that there is a, I don't know if it's a phobia, but certainly at the very least, a wariness of foreigners in Japan in this period. And so I just wondered to ask about that because, you know, the Portuguese obviously managed to get a foothold in trade. As we know, yourself are Dutch and the Dutch have a strong relationship with the Japanese. But is that something that the Japanese were unhappy with, but it was a fact of life and they had nothing, there was little they could do about it? Or was it something that they embraced a little bit more than perhaps we were previously aware?
Well, on the one hand, they saw the Westerners as southern barbarians. Southern because they came from the south. So seen from the Japanese cultural standpoint, they were dealing with barbarians. But on the other hand, there were quite a few warlords and samurai who converted to Christianity and who admired some of the exoticism of Christianity. So you have a lot of art objects, for example, crosses, music also they introduced in Japan, paintings and such things. So there was some admiration for the culture, but as an exotic culture, not as the pure Japanese culture, to say so. And the Jesuits were well aware of that, so they tried their best to learn Japanese culture and behave like the Japanese. So, for example, we have the tea ceremony in Japan, which was very much valued among the Japanese. So the Jesuits, they tried to incorporate the tea ceremony. When a distinguished guest came to their church, they would entertain them with tea, for example. Or you have poetry. Poetry was very important for the Japanese, and I've advised the producers and Justin to have poetry in the series. And you will see a lot of poetry going on because poetry for the Japanese samurai was a symbol of the aridity of culture. So a good samurai had to be good at poetry. So the Jesuits, they also learned Japanese poetry because it was necessary to impress the Japanese to have that level of culture.
Well, there's a poem in the first episode, I think. So that's good to see that
Already.
they listen to you.
Yes. Because they made the poems. It say I've made the poems for them, following the conventions of that time. Because Japan had a rich tradition of renga, so linked first poetry, which had a lot of conventions, and I really wanted to have such poems in the show. So I studied hundreds of them of the time to be able to compose some of them to be used in the show. And I'm really glad that they took them. So
that is very interesting to me because you have a Dutchman living in Japan writing Japanese poems in an American production featuring British actors and a jazz actor saying your words. That's wonderful.
Yes. So you can say it like that, yes.
Yeah. The great Hiroki Sanada plays Yoshi Toranaga, who I think is based on I'm sure I'm butchering the pronunciation, but I think he's based on Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Yes,
and he's a key figure, isn't he? But I just wanted to ask, he's one of the five warlords, but he's not quite graduated to shogun yet, because I was just interested in the hierarchy. You have shogun and then there's samurai. It would just be good to understand exactly what the roles were.
Yeah, so Ieyasu was the most powerful warlord at the time. And so he was the leader, to say, of the Council of Regents. So he had the most power, but in the show, he has a little bit less power, to say so. And the other regents, which were in reality smaller lords, are in the show much more powerful lords. So that we really have a council of five regents, which are quite equivalent in power, to say so. So that's quite a difference with the history. Because in the history, the other regions, they managed to have a large army to fight against Tokugawa Ieyasu. But still, there was quite a difference in size of their holdings and so on. So that we changed so that it would be much, much thrilling for Toranaga, which is modeled on this Ieyasu, so that Toranaga would have much more obstacles. And he is not yet shogun. I don't know if he will become shogun in this season. We will see.
And shogun is sort of the warlord for the whole of Japan, is that right?
Yes. So shogun can be seen as the military leader of Japan, the top, to say so. It's quite complicated, but let's say that from the Kamakura period, so from the 12th century, end of the 12th century on, shogun was seen as a military leader. If you get that title, which was bestowed by the emperor, which had only power in name, not real power at the time, then you could say that you could unify the country, and have all the warlords had to be subordinate to this leader. So that was really something which one could aspire to, but only people from a certain lineage. And Toranaga, like Ieyasu, has that lineage. So he is a candidate for that post.
I was very interested because we see this quite frequently, certainly in the first episode, is there is this maybe culture is too strong a word, but there is this practice of suicide. Why is it so prevalent in the culture at the time in Japan? Because we saw it even in the Second World War with Japanese soldiers viewing people who surrendered as in somehow inferior.
Well, why this custom developed, that's something we don't know. We know that the samurai, they valued honor very much. So when they were defeated on the battlefield, if they were catched and executed, that would be a shame. So they choose to cut their belly, which was a very painful thing to do. And if you cut your belly, you won't die immediately. So you will be in much pain. So that's why they have the kaishakunin, a person who helps them. And after they cut their belly, this person will cut their neck so that they will immediately die at that point. But why they did it, because it was such a painful thing to do. So by doing that, they showed their courage. And by showing their courage, they would be remembered afterwards as having had a very honorful death. And this is something the samurai really wanted to do. They wanted to have their name remembered generations after they died. That was one thing. So that was one aspect of committing suicide in that way. And in the beginning, samurai did that, and gradually it became accustomed to do it. So if you were a samurai and you were defeated, if you didn't commit suicide, it would be a shame. So it became a sort of codes of conduct which they had to adhere to. So that's a little bit the history behind that. And afterwards, at the end of the Sengoku period, it also became a punishment for samurai. So if they did something wrong, the Lord would order them to commit seppuku. But it you don't have to assume that it was a dishonorable thing to do. It was an honorable death. So by doing this seppuku, they reestablished their honor, to say so. And people who did really serious crimes, they wouldn't be allowed to commit seppuku. They would be executed. So that was the difference between the right to do it and the right not to do it, to say so.
And I suppose with Christianity arriving, then that's a great sin in Christianity.
Indeed. So that will be one of the themes of the show. So people who are Christian, but who come in a situation when they have to commit suicide. So how will they cope?
Yeah, it's the clash of cultures was just so interesting to me in the first series. But I guess best depicted with the language difficulty, where you have the Englishman, obviously English speaking, Portuguese, and I mean, everyone's translating amongst each other to try and work out what they're all saying. I mean, that must have been a frequent challenge for those foreigners in Japan.
Yes, and many foreigners really learn the language good. So you have people like William Adams, for example, who was known to speak Japanese fluently, but he couldn't really write it. So not many foreigners, I think, who could write Japanese, but many who could speak, Jesuits who lived long in the country, who studied the language, for example, were there, and even Dutch people who resided for a long time in Japan, they also spoke fluently Japanese. But what we have done in the show, which I really wanted them to do, was to use medieval Japanese. So it's not the Japanese you will hear today. And well, it's not 100% medieval Japanese, because if we did that, then a modern Japanese public couldn't understand. But we have put in a lot of grammatical aspects of the language at the time, ways in which they spoke. So I'm really satisfied that the actors were ready to use that language. On the other hand, I didn't dare to ask the producers to have the Westerner speaking Portuguese. So that's had become English. I think that would be too much for them, but as a whole, it worked out quite well.
Yeah, I think so. It's interesting you say that. That does lend authenticity to the show, I think. I guess that leads me to a question. Do you think we get it right, as in we in the West? I say we, basically Hollywood, or now the streamers and creating these incredible shows. But in their depictions of Japan, obviously this version of Shogun, there was one in the 80s, which many may be familiar with. There are, of course, there's the Tom Cruise film. And, we're very influenced by Japanese cinema, I know, but I wondered if we get the depictions right.
Well, I think the Tom Cruise film was not bad. It's a totally different period. It's the end of the Edo period, so 250 years after our show. And one thing I've done in advising the people of Shogun was we have to get the record straight, and we have to use everything like it was in the Sengoku period in 1600. So a lot of Japanese period dramas, they look at the Sengoku period through the eyes of the Edo period, because that's closer to their period. But a lot of things have changed in the Edo period. And they really did a very good job to reconstruct everything as it was in the Sengoku period. I've spent hours and hours with them on the sets, on the costumes, but also on how samurai at the time, how would they react? How would they react in certain situations? What would they do? A funny thing is, in the trailer, you see a lot of fighting scenes, but most of the show is not about fighting. There's a lot of cultural elements in it. We have no theater, we have a tea ceremony, we have several occasions when they compose poetry. And I must say, I have given them hundreds of details of the time, and Justin and his team, he has incorporated all those details in the story. So it really is a voyage into that period. You could show the show as an introduction to Sengoku period culture, to say so. And as a historian, that's really a great satisfaction that I got from that.
Encouraging to hear that. There's a scene when I laughed out loud, actually, quite early on, when I think all the English sailors are in their sort of dungeon or their hole in the ground, and the local thief appears, and they're both insulting each other, and they're both calling each other savages and barbarians, and it's just wonderful. It just captured that kind of, I guess, that moment where two cultures collide, both thinking they're superior to the other.
Yes, that's really what happened at that time too. So you have the Westerners who think that they come from a superior culture, and especially the ideology, the Christianity that they have. While the Japanese see these people as southern barbarians coming to their shores. And I have to say that the Jesuits, I think I pointed out before already, that they looked with admiration to Japanese culture. So, but ordinary sailors, they will see Japan as completely different from their own culture and see it more as savages than something else.
But then the moment one sees this amazing recreation of Osaka when this ship
Oh,
arrives in the...
yes.
If you were one of those sailors who had that sentiment, those feelings would fall away on sighting Osaka.
That's another aspect which you really have to put that into the show. Osaka, it was a world town at the time, and the castle of Osaka was as big as a town in England to see. So when a foreigner arrived in Osaka, he would be completely in awe to what he sees. It's a very rich culture which envelops before his eyes. So, and that they have done really great, and a lot of work has been done to reconstruct the city as it was at that time. So, also very great, and I really love that scene too.
Well, how was Osaka compared to, say, what was the other sort of rival cities in Japan at the time?
Well, you have Kyoto, the capital, which was quite close to Osaka, was also a very large city because the emperor had its seat in Kyoto. And then you have had the Taiko, Hideyoshi, who had his castle in Osaka. And he really built Osaka from scratch. So he was the first to make completely planned city. So all the streets you probably seen were straight, and the canals were straight, and he brought all those people in the town from all parts of Japan to create a colossal new town there. So with everything in it, quarters for the warlords to build their residences, quarters for the merchants, a harbor. So everything was there.
So, Frederick, you've been in Japan, I think, more than 20 years, probably longer.
I've been in Japan for 35 years now.
35 years.
Yes.
Wow. So, do you feel like you are Japanese?
Well, I have Japanese nationality, and I must say I studied Japanese history. I'm a professor in Japanese history, and I worked most part of my life in Japanese circumstances. If you do history in Japan, you don't have any connection with the West, to say so. Because they are totally focused on their own history. And with Shogun, 3 years ago, they asked me to join and to supervise all the historical aspects. So that was the first time that I worked in English. And with foreigners, to say so, from a Japanese standpoint. And it was really amazing experience because everything I thought was natural for me, I had to explain from the beginning, from nil to say so. What is a samurai? What is shogun? How was the city of Osaka built and so on? So it was really amazing experience, and my English has become much better than in the beginning. In the beginning, I was thinking, how do you say that in English and that?
Well,
And
it's very good, your English.
thank you very much. So it's 3 years of working with the team of Shogun. And also, it inspired me to write a book on William Adams, on the background of Shogun, which will be out in May this year.
Fantastic. Fantastic. And what about, I think we're running, I've got like 1 minute left, I think I'm being told. But I was very interested in your the Japanese cast in particular. How were they? Did you speak with them about the medieval culture?
Yes. They were, how to say, they were fantastic in the way that they acted, for example, and in the way they spoke. I think they really got into their characters in a Sengoku mind. And you have a kind of Japanese period dramas, which are much more Edo specific based. So they are different than the Sengoku period. And I thought that they really assimilated very well to a Sengoku state of mind, to say so. So I'm really amazed at their acting, and but everyone was perfect, and also Cosmo Jarvis was also perfect, because he had to act in a different way than Chamberlain did before. He couldn't just try to do the same thing. So he really did a very good job to make a new character, to say so. And I think closer to the book, to Clavell's book than Chamberlain, because the show in 1980 was much more centered on a Western guy discovering an exotic new culture, to say so. Well, now we have, like you said, a clash of cultures. So,
yeah.
So both sides really did very well. I'm very satisfied with what they accomplished.
Good stuff. Well, Frederick, this has been really, really fantastic to speak to you. Thank you very much for your time. And yeah, I wish you all the best for the, I hope you get to a premiere and you're treated like royalty, because it's a great show.
Thank you very much. That's a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening. Coming up, it's the attack on Pearl Harbor. And then on Saturday, Gordon returns talking about great British commanders from World War I, the also-rans. But until then, thank you. And good night.